This is a production of Cornell University.
Okay, let's get started. I'd like to call this special meeting of the University Assembly to order. It's August 21st, 2020. I apologize for the short notice in calling the meeting, but events are happening quickly on campus. We passed on some information on behalf of the University Assembly to the President and Provost a day or so ago and asking if they had a chance to talk with us about it. And the Provost responded that he'd be happy to meet with us during this time slot. So that's the primary purpose of the call and the reason for the short notice. The Provost has since notified us that he's going to be delayed a bit, we think until 2:30. We decide to proceed with the meeting beginning at 2 in any event. And I will suggest that we spend a full hour with the Provost once he comes on, which means we'll probably have to vote for an extension.
Bob, if I could just interject, I wasn't aware of the delay. I'm happy to leave and come back at 2:30 if that would be the preference of the Assembly.
It's a public meeting. You're welcome to stay. We'll just talk in general about what we might want to talk with the administration, but the Provost, you, in the meanwhile. And we have a few other business things, too, which have come up. Lots of things are happening. So we'll be chatting about those, but it's an open meeting, and you're more than welcome to stay on, Jill. Thank you. Thanks for letting me know you're here. We'll take the role of the actual members in just a minute, and we are asking that if you are a University Assembly member, that you go to your name and rename yourself UA somebody or other. So you can see that UA Pilar is there and UA Bob Howarth is there, and that way it's a little easier for us to track. In terms of the rules of the meeting, I'm going to give preference to UA members in terms of speaking and asking questions, but as time allows and as opens allow, others can be asked to be recognized as well, and we'll do that by having you raise your hands at the appropriate time. I believe what we've hopefully have disabled the chat function. I'm not 100% sure, but I ask that you not use it. I would really like the conversation to be oral and amongst us all and recorded and not confused by side conversations in chat. So. With that, Gina, can you call the roll of members? And
yes. Andy Barrientos Gomez. Christopher Barth. Uche Chukwukere. Cody Duell.
Here.
Brandon Fortenberry. David Heiner.
Here.
Alex Hong. Adam Howell.
Here.
Logan Kenny.
Here.
Carolyn Levine.
Here.
Gavin Martin. Renelle Mensa.
Here.
Deborah Niakaru. Jeff P.
Here.
Charlie Van Loan.
Here.
Pilar Thompson.
Here.
And Bob Howarth.
Here.
Gina, you didn't call my name.
Richard, we were informed that your appointment had run out as of the end of May. So
Charlie, could you speak to that?
Wait, can I interrupt and say that there are some people who are called who have graduated and other people whose terms have technically ended outside of the GPSA? I think that a lot of other terms have ended, including the employee assembly terms.
Okay, we're responding to the information as it's been supplied to us by the various assemblies is the answer to that. I just received a message saying that Mike Kotlikoff is actually with us at the moment and not-
And I've joined Bob. Hi. Hey.
Thank you, Mike.
Charlie, could you speak to my membership?
Why don't we get to the list?
I want to participate in the meeting, and
you're welcome to participate in the meeting.
It's a public meeting. Why don't we just proceed?
It's a public meeting. I don't think we're going to be taking any votes. I'm delighted to have you here, Richard. Let's discuss it later.
I have a question of information. I've asked three times for the questions that were sent in to be sent to the members of the UA. There's a very good reason for that. I could go into it, but I'd like a decision, yes or no, whether we are denied access to the questions before the session begins.
I received a summary of the questions late morning, I believed. I've gone through them. My intent was to the extent possible, have direct questions for Mike as the meeting goes along, and then to interject those from outside of the members as time allows and as appropriate. So I have so far chosen not to share them publicly beyond that. Mike, welcome. I appreciate you taking the time to join with us. Let me just spend one other minute, since I thought you were going to be delayed a little bit, and I want to just make two other points to the full assembly. One is that we have an emergency need to appoint more members to the hearing board panels, which is critical given the campus reopening and problems around that. Pilar, Jeff, Uche, and I met this morning with the acting judicial administrator, Barbara Krause, and came up with a strategy. We have the power to make the emergency appointments, but we want the full UA to weigh in on that. So our thought is to have a online discussion over the next 5 days on input, try to get some diverse candidates if we can, and then next Wednesday, the executive board will act on what we think is the best interests of the community. I also contacted Madeline Wessel, University Counsel, briefly earlier today. She says she has code revisions almost ready to share with us. She hopes to get those to us soon. At that point, we will try to have a public discussion on those. So with that, the prime purpose of this meeting is to have a discussion with Provost Kotlikoff on the issues and concerns we've put forward. And Mike, do you wanna just briefly address these and then we'll open up to questions? Does that work for you?
Sure. So I'm sorry, Bob, I don't have the questions in front of me. Thought I would come and respond to your questions. I can give updated data on a number of things I can do. I just left the trustees meeting where I gave an updated report on where we are in terms of testing data and, you know, all the issues that we're really trying to monitor on a daily basis, our quarantine capacity, our local health capacity, everything. So, probably best if I answer your direct questions.
Okay. The immediate context was that we received some information from Jason Chang, who is a graduate student and one of the RAs in a dorm, who is very concerned about some processes. So, approval of the UA and with Jason's agreement, I had forwarded those to you and to Martha Paul.
Yeah. So maybe I'll just. Update a little bit because Ryan, Pat Wynn, Mary Opperman, and I met yesterday with the representatives from the RAs from North Campus and went through, delivered their demands and their concerns. And, you know, I have to say it was a terrific meeting. The number one thing is these are students that have the best interests of other students at the core of their concerns. And I think I think we all agreed that some of these concerns were around communication about what's available. Some of it, you know, so for example, concerns that related to their health and safety, the PPE that's available, how they would get more if they needed it, whether they're being constrained in any way and their health is being put at risk. And so I think we resolved all those issues where, you know, the whole idea of this is to provide individuals with all the necessary PPE and components that they need. And we resolved that. The second issue really, I think, relates to the stress that the RAs are under, some of which precedes COVID and some of which of course relates to COVID. And that is that they are somewhat understaffed, seeing more students responsible for more students, concerned about their conditions that, they're facing, their preparation in other areas. And I think we had a good conversation and talked about that as well, issues, things that we can do to resolve those issues. But I don't, those are a little bit more complicated, and I don't want to underestimate the significance of those. And then the last elements were what I would call longer term concerns about compensation, issues like hazardous pay, that sort of thing, that are really more complicated. And we agreed to basically undergo a mutual process about that, where we're going to start a process where we discuss those issues on a formal basis. And Ryan, I don't think it's public yet, but they requested that the university formally attest to that, which we were glad to do. And Ryan has written a document to them, which I've seen, which will be publicly released. And of course, they last night publicly went to the Daily Sun and talked about the progress that was made in the meeting. There are a number of issues. There's a lot of anxiety. There's anxiety, employees, faculty, staff, community, completely understandable. One of the things that we're trying to do is address that anxiety by having as much transparency as possible. As I said last night on the town hall for faculty and staff, Monday we will put forward a dashboard, and I can actually show you a mock-up of that dashboard now just to let you see. But that dashboard will be completely transparent about all the tests that are done, all the individuals that are positive as associated with those tests, our local health capacity, so ICU beds and ventilators and patients under physicians' care in our local community. A third area will be quarantine and isolation capacity, so making sure that we have enough that we can handle those. And then a fourth, our testing program, making sure that we have the supplies to continue the testing. We have a mandate to be a month out for supplies, so we have enough supplies in two separate systems to go through September. So all of that, and that will roll up into a dashboard that gives us a color-coded and gives the community a color-coded alert level. So are we operating in green, and what does that mean? Do we go to yellow, where we modify some procedures, then orange, then red, which is shutdown, and what are the triggers for shutdown? It'll all be explicit in that. And I think, you know, as some of the anxiety is, there are a number of people that have been working flat out to get us to a position where we can address the health concerns of the community, which are significant, whether we open and understandably, as part of that, I think we've been a little delayed in some things. Another area we've been delayed in is frankly, student enrollment, which we're about to launch next week. So that's a sort of little update on the RAs and a little bit more on data. Now, I will say also, we got a letter today from West Campus RAs, and there's concern there. We're going to, Ryan and I are going to talk today. We'll likely meet with the West Campus RAs. Again, some of the information that is in that letter and in Jason Chang's letter I have concerns with. So for example, in Jason's letter, the idea that somehow students, quarantine students moving into the dorms before they were tested was somehow a significant breach of our policy. And I'll say a few words about that. But the more over, and the fundamental issue here is our assumptions don't rely on 100% or don't rely on perfection. Mistakes are going to happen. This is an enormously complicated effort. The Fraser modeling has a lot of these built into that modeling. And so far, we're well below our positive assumptions of where we would be. Those assumptions were, for example, 2% of students coming in from non-quarantine states would be positive, and 4% from quarantine states. We're an order of magnitude lower than that. We're in better shape than that. And I can show you that those data or give you those data. So that fundamental assumption. Now, let me go back to the dorms because, so what happened was we had this plan precipitated by New York State's extension of states up to 30, 34 at one place, it's 33 now, that required quarantine. We said we don't have enough quarantine space locally, and this has gotten so big that we're going to have students from Binghamton to Syracuse, and we're not comfortable with the risk associated with that. We can't oversee that or monitor it. So we said to students, stay home. And we said to every student, and we accepted every student with a need to come into quarantine. That turned out to be roughly 400 students. Every student that applied with need was accepted. So we tried to address the equity concerns, the reasonable equity concerns that faculty had. Those students came in, roughly 20 students came in late that evening after the testing sites had closed. Now, understand that students had come in at normal time, had been tested and gone into the dorms. They didn't have their results. Those students could have been positive. The students that came in afterwards went into their dorms. They could still be positive. They weren't tested. They were tested the next morning. This is a distinction without a difference. There's not really, and they all went into single rooms. This is not an issue that one says, oh my God, Cornell is now breaching its compact with the community. So that kind of thing, I certainly understand the anxiety, but we have to recognize the reality here and the fact that we're monitoring this on an ongoing basis. And 0.1% of those quarantined students, I think the number was higher. It was, I think, now I'm not sure. It was three or one of those roughly 400 students were positive. So well below the 4% that we had assumed from the modeling.
Okay, that's extremely helpful. I appreciate that you're going up with the dashboard next week. I think transparency on information and more immediate transfer of information would go a long way towards helping or everyone in the community, I'm sure, including you, certainly me, everyone has anxiety over this, but more we know, the better it's going to be. Why don't we open it up for questions with that? And again, if you want to ask a question, please put up your hand. I think I can see it. I don't see any hands at the moment, so maybe I can't. Pilar, you can help me with that. I will give preference to UA members and Richard, by all means. But if others have questions, I'll try to work you in as time allows. And we'll go to David. I don't see your hand, but you had put an advanced question in. Do you want to deliver it orally?
Thanks, Bob. And thanks, Mike, for coming to talk to us. This is really helpful. And it's good to know that you guys are working with the RAs to address some of their issues. My question is pretty simple. Given the fact that the university has a high visibility in the community and in some regards nationally, it seems like it's really important to make sure that we get this right. And it's so early on, and to hear these maybe they're isolated issues, I'm not sure. But they're issues nonetheless that we're hearing from the RAs. So I'm wondering what the senior administration is doing to ensure that these policies are being adhered to. And also, can you talk about how the senior administration is making sure the policies are followed on the grounds? Are people making like spontaneous checkups to make sure things are going according to plan? You know, those kinds of things.
Yeah. Thanks, David. So to your point about compliance, so as you know, every student that is enrolling needs to sign a behavioral compact. Before signing that behavioral compact, they go through a training video and then a test on that training video that talks about transmission of COVID, and their responsibility, their community responsibility. We also have launched a campaign. If you've been on campus, you've seen the signs around campus, modified facilities and classrooms, et cetera. We've done a changing of ventilation within classrooms. We've got training videos now that are up and informational information and frequently asked questions for faculty and students about how to behave in certain situations. Now, having said all that, your question goes to compliance and how we're ensuring that or doing what we can to do that. Understanding, and I want to emphasize this, we will not have 100% compliance. You know, I get emails. I saw a student in Bell Sherman without a mask. You know, what are you doing? The whole thing is falling apart. I do want to reassure you that fundamental to this is our surveillance testing, so that we test, undergraduates are going to be tested twice a week throughout the semester. And that is designed to pick up any infection before it can spread. We have community spread, isolate those individuals and their contacts. But directly to your question, the compact is going to be monitored by roughly 100 staff, mostly athletic coaches that are not doing a lot of coaching right now, that are going through and they're individuals that have been in this situation with students in the past, and they will be going around on campus. They're not going to get every place, but it's 100 of those, and then 300 students who are going to do peer-to-peer, who are hired to do peer-to-peer, you know, assessment, coming up to individuals that are not complying, if you're not wearing a mask, et cetera, et cetera. In addition to that, we have MPH students who are going around the campus, who have questionnaire, who are taking data, who's wearing masks, who's in Duffield not wearing a mask, who are. And then the last point that I would make is that all of us have a responsibility to model good behavior and to say something when we see inappropriate behavior. We have an anonymous report website that we've stood up where you can go and report these behaviors. That's another way we'll do that. We can follow up. We've said we know and we have told students, this is in the compact, that if they have parties in their houses, their apartments, they are responsible as the apartment leasee for those activities. We have said, the language says, let me see if I can read you the language for the behavioral compact. Yeah, here it is. Severe, pervasive, and or repeated violations may lead to suspension. So students have to sign that they understand that that's the case, and they will be part of that. That will be a judicial code violation. So that's what we have in place. But I, you know, having said all that, I cannot assure you or anyone or would never try to say that we're going to have zero deviation from our compact. That it's just not possible. And our system is designed with a kind of nested barriers of protections, nested safety protections. First and foremost is gateway testing or arrival testing. Then this surveillance testing, testing for cause. Anybody that has symptoms goes to Cornell Health, but also, you know, social distancing, mask wearing, these policies, travel policy, lack of a group, you know, prohibition of group activities, no Greek events. All of this is part of an overall process that we think can be give us a positive residential semester.
Let me just
but if we're wrong, and I want to make this point, if we're wrong, we will shut down. We will shut down based on data, not based on emotion. And I think that's a key point. Sorry.
Yeah, thank you for that, Mike. Let me just interject that when the UA Executive Board met this morning with Barbara Krauss, the acting judicial administrator, she said that there are half a dozen cases that have been referred to her as extreme behavior. So I don't know if that's a good sign or a bad sign, but it's a, it's a sign that the system's working at some level. Logan's the only hand I see. If others want to speak, put your hands up. But Logan, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Bob. And thank you, Mike, for coming today. And nice to see you again, Joel. My question is about testing. I know that starting September 2nd, there are going to be various locations across the board. But right now, for students who are just arriving, I know if they try to sign in, it says that there's no availability. And technically, you can show up the same day and get testing. I just want to know if that has been communicated to the community, because I know at least in the law school and some of the graduate programs, it hasn't been, and we've had to call Cornell Health.
Yes, thank you. We know that is a problem, Logan. And so here's the problem. The initial problem was students were signing up for more than one date, and they weren't showing up. So they were taking all the times, and there were no sign up times. We eliminated that possibility, but what's still happening is students sign up and they don't show up. We had 800 kids sign up this week for one day on Tuesday, something like 450 or less than 500 kids showed up for that test. Meanwhile, we had all this capacity. We did take people, as you say, that just came and didn't have a slot. And we're now opening up more slots so that you can have an arrival and just come if you can't get an appointment. We're also opening up more appointments. And to your point, I believe, but I will check, that that's getting communicated to all students in terms of just go, don't wait, even though it may take a little longer, et cetera.
Okay, awesome. Thanks so much, Mike. Just a quick follow-up. For students with Cornell health insurance, are they able to go to the other testing sites and be seen, like by the mall, or if Wegmans is still open, are they accepted at those locations?
Yeah, I think, Logan, that the mall location is run by Cuga Medical, and my understanding is for that, you need to have either a physician's order, you need to have a medical reason to go and be tested. If you just show up and say, I'm an arrival testee, without a specific appointment or connection there, I don't think they'll test you. However, for move-in, my understanding is that has been arranged. So starting Sunday for move-in, parents can drive in, drive through. That's one of the options for going through. I'm like 95% sure that's correct, but I can check on it.
I'll boost that to 100%. That is in fact accurate.
Okay. Thank you, Joel. I don't have all the specifics of the testing, but I do think that we have heard the problem of availability issues and timing issues. And one other thing, we've also heard, Logan, that, concern that students have come in, they're being tested, and then they won't be tested again until September 2nd. And we have now instituted an additional test in that. And now I have to describe the two different testing. We're doing arrival testing, which is a nasopharyngeal swab, a sort of gold standard nasopharyngeal swab, conducted where the test is conducted at Cuga Medical. Then we're shifting during this period now to our surveillance testing, which we're doing at the vet school, which is an anterior nares test. You take a swab, twirl it around one nostril, put it in the other, twirl it around, put it in a tube. That will go much faster and be much much easier. And we're starting that, we're building that in before September 2nd. And that will test, that's what we will shift to and test 50,000 students per week. The students, faculty, and staff per week.
Awesome, thank you so much, Mike. And I'm really glad to hear that we're opening up availability. That's incredibly helpful.
Thank you.
Thank you. Richard, I see your hand up. Just for context, Richard, five of the eight advanced questions we got are from you. So I ask perhaps you pick one of those now and then come back to others if others don't have other questions. But Richard, the floor is yours.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for coming.
Hi, Richard. Sure.
And it's good to have the update on the negotiations with the RAs. I have some questions that come out of their concerns that you really didn't quite address in your opening comments. So I'll just list them fast. I'm since there are no other hands up, I think that's okay. The first one of their concerns, as I understand it, is that there's no director of residential life, that the position has been vacant for some months. And I wondered, you know, what progress is being made to fill that, because it looks like an important one. Another concern they had.
Okay, let me take this one at a time, Richard, because I'll forget them. I don't know the answer to that. That did not come up as one of the issues from the RAs when we met with them. We met with them with Tim Blair and Pat Wynn. Pat is, of course, in charge of the dorms and facilities, and Tim Blair, I think, is either close to that role or so. I don't know if there's an acting or what that is, but it did not arise as a problem in our discussions with the RAs.
Yes, I want to emphasize, I'm not speaking for the RAs. I mean,
yep.
I know some of them, and they've expressed concerns, but I'm in no way representing them. Another concern they had, and you addressed it in part, was the RA staffs. I mean, there are a lot of vacancies.
Yes.
And one of the questions is, when are those going to be filled? As I understand it, there are 9 RAs in one of the dorms for 400 plus students, The ratio is not good. So that's a question. I mean,
Let me talk about that. So one of the things we talked about, and this is not my domain, but pre-COVID, a year ago, there was an effort really to start looking comprehensive at the RA. At the RA position and the RA situation, and have a real review of this. So Ryan initiated this. He has been an RA in his career and knows a lot about this and feels like there are a lot of problems with our RA program. Or let me say that a different way. There's a lot of improvements that we can make. And so that process started, but got shoved aside associated with all the work that's going on with COVID. What we resolved with the RAs is to reinvigorate that discussion and empower the RAs themselves to be part of that discussion. Because we do acknowledge that there are these kids are incredibly dedicated, but they're overloaded, as you state. And one of the things we did say was one of their requests, one of their demands was that we suspend this requirement that they meet with every student on a weekly basis for a period of time when they have, each one of them has so many students. So that's not a perfect solution for this, but it is something that addresses the current status. So we haven't fixed it, Richard, but we're aware of it and working on it, and importantly, working with the RAs on it.
Another concern they had, I think a more serious one, is that the maintenance staff in the dorms are not wearing masks or practicing proper protocol. And this has two effects. I mean, it endangers students to some extent, but it also makes it seem as if the protocols don't matter, and it weakens compliance generally.
Sure.
I know you will work on this.
So let me just say that that's not one I heard, but what I heard, and from faculty, I met with Rosemary Avery two nights ago who's representing the West Campus faculty. And what I'd heard was that the non-compliance was associated with staff that are outside, like Big Red Movers and others that were part of the quarantine moving, and that they were very concerned that people were not wearing masks. And we elevated that and raised that and have raised that with the individuals. I have not heard that SEL staff are not wearing masks. I can take that up with Ryan, but I would, you know, so much of this is third hand, Richard. I would be a little, particularly since the RAs themselves did not raise this. I'm just wondering if that's accurate or how extensive.
Well, I don't know whether it's accurate. It was firsthand given to me. I mean, it came directly from RAs and from people I know and would trust implicitly. The last thing, the suggestion they had, and it's just a helpful one, is if my understanding is that the protocols for the dorms are not posted publicly or not posted publicly everywhere, or they're not complete or whatever it is. But posting the protocols publicly would really help these kids, because what happens is they can't enforce invisible rules.
Enough said. That this did come up, Richard, and we resolved to provide them with a postable behavioral guidelines that they can put up in the dorms. And Ryan's group is working on that. That was a to-do we took from that meeting. It's a great point.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard. Let me bring up a question that is one of the ones that was posted online in response to our message yesterday. So this is from a student. Please. And says that in the email dated yesterday, it was noted that students, including grad students, are required to participate in surveillance testing. However, in the next paragraph, it indicates they will be notified through the Daily Check website. The problem is not all grads are enrolled in the Daily Check if they're not coming to campus. Most grads in our department, this individual says, are not authorized to work, come back to campus, and so are not registered for the Daily Check. This seems like a glaring omission in the plan. Please address.
Yeah, I believe every student gets a Daily Check email every day. I get one every day. And that allows you to respond whether you're on campus or not. Now, the only way you don't get a Daily Check will be if you opt out as a residential student. So if you say, I'm in the boys and I'm all online. And I should say, one of the things that now appears is going to happen, and this addresses some of Richard's questions, is it looks like we're going to have about 70% occupancy of the dorm, 70% normal occupancy. So there are a significant number of students who are not coming, and that's going to de-densify the dorms and from a number of standpoints provide some advantages. But to describe what we're actually doing, Bob, is we responded to a lot of students, both undergrads, but particularly graduate students, who said and emailed me personally, I live in Ithaca, I don't have to be on campus, I'm pursuing my thesis in history or philosophy, and I don't have to be on campus, and I don't want to take a TCAT bus to come up to campus to be tested. I'm isolated and you're going to put me at risk. And so we said to those individuals, we've got an opt-out component of this. We've also got a sort of, on the other side, opt-in in the sense that graduate students who are student-facing, our standard is all undergrads tested twice a week, graduate students once a week or once every other week, depending on level of involvement, grad and professional, and same for faculty and staff. Now, on the other side, if you're a student-facing graduate student or a student-facing faculty member, you can opt in for twice a week testing. So if that gives you more assurance and alleviates concerns. So some of this uncertainty may be around that, but I don't think I'm not aware of a fundamental flaw here that's not providing an email daily check to any individual that has, that is essentially enabled to access the campus.
Okay, thank you for that. Logan?
Hi again, Mike. Sure. So one quick question and then a more detailed one. The quick one will be, as for the protocol in the residence halls, will that also be emailed to students living in residence halls so that there's assurance that not only do they see it posted, but we know for a fact that they've received it? And secondarily, I'm wondering about mental health, which is a large concern for me this semester, as a lot of students are in Ithaca but may not be coming to campus. Is there anything that you know of that's either that CAPS is working on to see if there's more availability to see therapists or other avenues in which we can make sure that we keep mental health on the forefront?
Yeah, there's been a lot. Okay, so the first one I will take as a to-do from this to talk to Student and Campus Life about that protocol and making sure that it gets emails to students, gets emailed to students. On the mental health, there's a number of things that Student Health is undertaking in this domain. We're all worried about this problem. This is going to be a significant challenge for us because students are going to be in dorms more likely, there'll be more time in dorms and by themselves than they would be otherwise. Issues around quarantine. It's a lot of work you may know from Student and Campus Life on this. It's the Q week and then ongoing activities that are quarantine week and then ongoing activities that are online for Zumba and yoga and lots of things to try and get us away from, be upstream of the mental health problem, really. But I'm not the best person to tell you exactly. I know there, I can send to the UA. Well, why don't I do this? Why don't I ask Ryan to respond to that question, because he'll give you the most up-to-date information about what Cornell Health has done to prepare for this and what other steps they've taken to try and avoid the mental health concerns that we're all worried about.
Thanks, Mike. That would be fantastic. One quick idea I had potentially, because I know that we have ambassadors for COVID-related instances on campus, but potentially setting up a mentorship program if people want kind of like a pen pal on campus. And I don't know who exactly that would go through, but to potentially try to keep students connected through distance.
Yeah, you know what I would suggest, Logan? Email Lisa Nishi, Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education, who's also been thinking really deeply about this, how to connect, how to continue progress on some of the issues, equity issues, race and equity issues that we're all concerned about, and making sure we don't sacrifice that as part of this effort to isolate, the reality of isolating students more than otherwise would be.
Great, thank you. I'll email her.
Sure.
Thanks for that. Let me just remind everyone, if you're not speaking, if you don't have the floor, please do mute your microphone so we get less feedback. I don't see any further hands from UA members at the moment.
Okay. Michelle is not.
I'm going to call on her, but I'm giving preference to UA members first. So UA members.
Before we have everyone go through, I just want to ask one quick favor as we continue, especially with those that are not UA members. Please let us know your full name or NetID so we're able to identify and track who will be speaking. I know some individuals just have a different sort of naming on their screen.
Thank you. Thank you, Laura.
That's great. And we'll take non-members' questions in just a moment. But just if a UA member wants to get your hand up, I'm looking. So in the meanwhile, Michelle Arteby, you have the floor.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's my first UA meeting, so thank you for allowing this to be open and participation. My name is Michelle Arteby. I'm the Director of Workforce Wellbeing and Human Resources. I have to tell you, that's quite a title to get right before a pandemic. It's been quite interesting. And in my purview is the work-life programming, which handles family life, the faculty and staff assistance program, which handles emotional support, and the wellness program, which handles physical support. And I really appreciated Logan raising mental health. That was kind of the direction I was headed, was mental health for employees. I can tell you that on our end, we're doing everything we possibly can to be prepared and to support individuals through this time. And I think for most folks that I've interacted with, they understand that our administration has really tried to keep our health and well-being first and foremost throughout all of this. But I am seeing the toll. I'm seeing a really significant toll on our faculty and staff. And I've never interacted with this number of faculty on, exhaustion and mental health issues and things like that. Have a lot of experience with our staff. I'm seeing it more and more in the faculty. And one of the things I just want to encourage us to think about is that not everyone needs therapy. Not everyone needs group support. People are exhausted. They're struggling with their workload. They can't keep this pace going. And while we can have a lot of these support services, we're also going to try to invest in, the ongoing self-sustaining work that people can do. I just felt it really was my responsibility to raise to you the fact that people are really struggling in the faculty and staff. And I know Mary has been just a phenomenal champion of employees throughout this entire time and employee well-being, and we're committed to it. I just ask that you also think about and talk about the mental health pieces for our entire community. I guess there's no real question in it other than to say thank you for your remarks in response to Logan. And, the other piece that our office handles is domestic violence issues that employees are facing. Our local agency has had a 50% uptick in hotline calls in Tompkins County. I serve on the board, and we're seeing that through Cornell cases as well. So there's a lot of well-being issues that play beyond just COVID for our faculty and staff. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of us out there doing the work, trying to help everyone. We appreciate the support. And please don't underestimate the power of your words of just raising mental health as an issue for our entire community.
Thanks, Michelle. And you, I would add to that, children and responsibilities of parents in K-12 and the concerns around what's going on with childcare and our public school system, all adding to an unbelievable amount of stress. And I fully admit, whenever I speak in the same forum with Mary, I'm always reminded that there is a sort of emotional side of me. I'm really about solving the problem, getting to make sure the task is done, getting us where we need to go. And there is an emotional component of this that Mary adds in those conversations that I often skip by. And it's something I'm working on, but I really do understand that stress and am concerned about it and concerned about the underlying issues. And I need to do a better job of raising them.
Thank you. Please know that wasn't an attempt at criticism.
No. I didn't take it that way, but it's reality.
We just appreciate whatever support we can get in that area.
My kids describe me as a blunt stick.
These are excellent points. I mean, the stress is very, very high on every member of the community. Forgive me if I mispronounce your name, but Ama Bema?
Hi, I want to thank the Assembly for making this, conversation open to the public. So I'm graduate resident fellow staff on West Campus, and I thought I would use this time to just ask a question that I've been sharing with my fellow staff members and that we are concerned about. So from my understanding, and if I'm wrong, please let me know, because communication on this would be very helpful. But from what I understand, the students that are coming in this Sunday, they'll be quarantining until they get their test results back, which is good. However, what is arising as a concern is the fact that they will still be sharing spaces with students who are in quarantine. They'll be sharing restrooms, hallways, all sorts of things. And even if they, hypothetically speaking, get a negative test or they get a positive test or something like that, they would have already been engaging and moving through the community. And one of the other things we're concerned about is for those people that get a false negative, and then they're told, okay, you're done with quarantine. That was very concerning to us as well. We're wondering if there's any way to extend the quarantine past just that one day, you know, after they've gotten their tests back, or what is being put in place to make sure that, you know, students that might have false negatives aren't just moving through the community without any sort of restrictions placed on their movement. Thank you.
Yeah, two great questions. So let me take the first one, Emma, about the quarantine and the conditions of quarantine. And you're right. You know, the ideal here would be the perfect situation would be if we had enough hotel spaces for every individual student to have quarantine conditions where they had their own room and their own bathroom and they didn't leave it. That is not a possibility because we simply don't have that number of rooms in our area. And as I said, we were reluctant to put people in Syracuse where they're not observed or Binghamton, et cetera. So there are some constraints. Now, let me just say that the data, the science is that if you wear a mask and are not within 6 feet of distance of an individual for 15 minutes, the likelihood of one individual passing COVID-19 to another individual is very, very, very low. So the reality is, I mean, all of us, those of us that go to Wegmans, go do this, we pass within people, we're less than 6 feet for a period of time, all the precautions in place, washing hands, hand sanitizing, et cetera, all of that makes the potential transmission not zero, but as close to zero as you can imagine. So I do want that, but you are absolutely right. That first wave of students will by necessity come into dedensified dorms. They'll go into individual rooms, but they will go to a bathroom that is a shared bathroom and be in a hallway, et cetera. That is something that we believe is not a very tolerable risk. So if people wear masks and socially distance, don't hang out, and don't hang out without their masks, there is a very, very low potential for transmission under those conditions. So I know this may be cold comfort to individuals in these areas. I will say my wife has taught for both Wednesday and Thursday to students in the vet school, closely packed. She teaches physical exam. She comes back. We again are in a situation where we rely on the science about these protective PPE and protective steps that we're taking. So it's not as though I'm saying it's fine for you because I'm not in contact with anyone. So now on the second point, and that is around, could the quarantine be extended because of false negatives? So this is an issue, and it's one that it's a very good point. But I do have to go into a little detail about what a false negative is. In general, most false negatives, and they can be from 10 to 30%, and our modeling assumes something around 20%. Most false negatives are either you haven't sampled appropriately, or a false negative in the sense that I met you, you had COVID-19, you transmitted it to me, and then I went and got a test, but I haven't, I don't have a viral load that's sufficient to be detected, and then I become positive in 2 days or 3 days. Now, our whole system is set up to identify people as early as possible in that mode, so that we will test you again in 3.5 days. So we're testing everybody twice a week, all these undergrads twice a week. And so that will pick, that is designed to pick up those individuals that are early in the stage, not infectious, and can't be detected and come up as a false negative, but then are detected the next time. There's not really a good way around that other than quarantining everybody, almost indefinitely, because we're all exposed to situations in which there could be false negatives. The best approach to that is, again, mask wearing and distancing. So these are nested barriers. We don't rely on any one thing. And I would say the last thing I'll say is, we don't have a zero risk situation. We don't have the luxury of a zero risk situation. We know even if we close the campus, we're all at risk because students are coming back, whether we want them to or not. And this possibility of transmission exists. So we've constructed the best situation that we can, but it is not perfect. And what I hear is you desiring more perfection from this. And the one thing I will say is that to address the point that you made, we've put the second test in between move-in and September 2, where we'll sample students in that 3-day window and be able to detect people that might have been positive.
Mike, we're almost out of time. Do you have time for a couple more questions, or are you?
Sure. Let me just look at my calendar.
It's almost 3. I don't want to keep you. I know your time's busy.
No, I do have. I have time until I schedule till 3:30.
Okay, so we'll just take some more questions. Let me skip ahead to Rennell Mensa, who's a UA member, and I'll come back to the others. Rennell.
Great. Thanks. So I had a question about enrollment. So there are students coming in on the 26th. And I think that's the last round of confirmed students who are supposed to be coming in. That is also the same day, the first day of enrollment. And for seniors, that starts at 9 a.m., I believe. So it's pretty early in the morning, and then it trickles out throughout the rest of the day. So I'm wondering, for students who are moving onto the dorm, how they're supposed to simultaneously move in and sign up for classes.
I'm not sure. I mean, it's a great point. Let me ask Lisa about this. You know that there will be a serial enrollment, so you'll have an opportunity to. So what will happen is juniors and seniors enroll first. They can take up to 6 credits. Then freshman and sophomore, a window opens. Then juniors and seniors, then freshmen and sophomores. So it seems like it could be possible to time that in a way in which you have, access, web access, and you can do this. But let me forward that concern to Lisa Nisha.
Great, thanks. And then I had one more follow-up. So we got an email yesterday from the university registrar saying that our checklist needs to be complete by this Sunday in order to enroll, and that's for the entire undergraduate population. So a part of that checklist says that you have to have scheduled a test in order to enroll.
Yes.
As has been said earlier, some dates aren't available, so students weren't able to sign up for a test. How are they supposed to secure their enrollment by this Sunday if their testing slots are not available?
Yeah, my understanding is that's the additional slots that are being opened up, but I'll also check on that. I believe that they're opening slots so that everybody can schedule. Now you don't have to. You just have to schedule. You don't have to be at there, right? So if we open things up for 2 days later or 3 days later or something, you're able to do that. I do think, so I guess there's two issues here. One is the surveillance, when you schedule your surveillance. The other is the arrival testing. Are you asking about the arrival testing?
Yeah.
The initial test? Yeah, so that we're opening up slots. There should be availability to do that. And we're also, you know, we've responded. I think what we're, we this issue that I mentioned earlier about going into the dorms if you haven't been tested, I believe they've secured additional hotel spaces for that first day, so that if people come late, they can go to a hotel instead of having to go in the dorm. So I know that's not your question. I'll check on this, making sure that we have enough slots so people can do the daily check-in.
Great.
Mike Greiner?
Yes, hi, thank you. I'm a graduate student in the government department. Mm-hmm. I wanted to follow up on the question about the daily check, which was actually a question that I submitted. So I know amongst the grad students in the department that I speak with and myself, we do not currently receive the daily check emails. And my understanding is that's because we are not approved or authorized to work on campus, and so we've not been enrolled in the daily check. And so I wanted to bring this up again because I wonder, is the plan to automatically enroll all students into the daily check program, or is that something, or how is that supposed to take place? Because right now we're not getting the email, so we wouldn't be notified.
I see. So Mike, I think, so I think what you're referring to is the transition between, you know, where we are right now, where certain people are enabled to come to campus because of they fit into their department's plans, the research plan or scholarship plan, to be able to occupy the campus prior to student move-in, and what happens when we release the daily check for student move-in. So I believe that what's going to happen is, yes, everybody is going to get the daily check-in, and then you have the opportunity to opt out. If you're a graduate student and don't want to come to campus, and you won't be allowed to come to campus, or if you know you'll opt in, and you'll determine what testing cadence you have. So I think that's what's going on. But again, let me make sure that I confirm that.
Great, thanks so much.
Maybe Mike, for several of these things, once you confirm them, if you could get back to.
Yeah, how should I?
I can pass it on to the assembly. That'll help.
Okay.
Get the message out, perhaps in part. Yeah. Becca Harrison.
Hi, thank you for stopping by and chatting with us. I want to address one of the big elephants in the room here. I have a few questions. So, why do we think we can do this when so many other universities are showing us that it's a lot harder right now than we thought it would maybe in May. So I'm obviously intimately aware of our unique modeling situation and the differences between our campus. But fundamentally, like, why are we any different? And if and when this actually does go poorly, as you said at the beginning, like, we would shut down. But I haven't heard anything about what that plan looks like. Obviously, as we watch other universities that are just a little bit bigger than us, but around the same size, hit this wall already, there's a lot of conversation about how do you send kids home without a plan, without just making everybody sicker? So how do we do this responsibly?
Yeah. So it's a great question, and believe me, I've gotten it a lot. Let me just say that there is a city. Yeah, so every university, every college is different, and they have different plans. UNC, I'm very familiar with. UNC had a plan where they did not have gateway testing, they did not have arrival testing, and they had no surveillance testing. They have a student body of 30,000 students. The first week of those students coming on campus, there were 350 tests. They tested only symptomatic people. We, from the beginning, knew that that was a disaster. We've developed this whole plan. We built a lab. We built the capacity, the additional capacity, because we were afraid of that condition. And we're seeing it roll out in university after university that hasn't done the work to recognize what you need to do to test asymptomatic individuals and identify positives before they spread. Now, Duke is down the road from UNC. Duke is doing very well. If you go on their website, they've got a very comprehensive surveillance program. They've got a student body, not much smaller than UNC. And they have de-densified significantly. So they're at about 50, 60%, I believe, of their student population. They've got a lot of off-campus students. They have not hit the wall that you've talked about. Notre Dame, I'm very worried about Michigan. Michigan does not have a program. They've got more than 30,000 students. A lot of the big schools have just decided we're going to open and roll the dice. And this is going to get, to me, Becca, it is going to get worse. There are going to be some disasters out there. So what is our approach? Why are we so full of ourselves? Have such hubris that I think I can, avoid all unknowns? Absolutely not. But what I do know is we're going to be looking at the data on a daily basis and making decisions based on data, not on somebody saying, oh my God, look what happened over there, or what makes you think you can do this, or that sort of thing. We're testing it on a daily basis. Now, to your last question about shutdown, we will have, what we will have is, as I said, green, yellow, orange, red. All the conditions, all the changes that we make as we go, if we go to yellow, if we go to orange, what are we doing? How are we responding to that situation to get us back to green? And if we go to red, how do we shut down in a responsible way? How do we make sure that we don't exacerbate, to your excellent point, exacerbate the condition once we've lost control? Now, we have the option of shutting down. One of the things is, even if we're in our nominative state, what we call our best case modeling, but we run out of testing supplies, or we run out of quarantine space because contacts, you can have one isolated person, one positive person, they could have 12 contacts. The county could identify 20 contacts. That's 20 rooms we need. We don't have enough quarantine space. That's another trigger to shut down. So the only thing I can answer to you is we've done the work to be able to be in a position to mount these nested barriers, protective barriers, key to which is surveillance testing. I'm suspicious of any university that hasn't done that. And I'm afraid that's going to be a problem. And we're not so committed to our own system that we're not changing if we need to. Go ahead.
Are you able to, like right now, give us numbers of that correspond with either cases or deaths along with this color scale?
Yeah, so I would say that for red, one of the numbers that we've decided on through extensive modeling again is 250 new cases in a week. In any 7-day period, if we have 250 new cases, now we'll have trends before, we'll have trends later, we'll see, we'll know if they're a spike, where those cases come from, did they come from a party, are they in College Town, are they in the dorms, lots of information that we'll have about this. If we have 250 new cases in a week, that's a trigger to say, consider shutdown. Then we look at all the other parameters, we look at the trends, we make a formal decision, a group of people, and believe me, health and safety of our community is number one. If it looks like it's going in a direction where we're getting community spread and we're not controlling this, we'll shut down.
Is there a number that also corresponds to the number of deaths among students or staff and faculty?
There's not a death number. That's not a number we could have zero deaths, Becca, and be shutting down. We could have one or two deaths and still be open. That would be extremely unfortunate. We don't, morbidity is a little bit more of a of a trigger in terms of epidemiology than mortality. Morbidity is the number of people that are sick. We want to keep the number of people sick to a minimum. We've had extensive conversations with Cayuga Health System, Marty Stallone, the CEO of Cayuga Health, about how we quantify our health system capacity, the number of cases that are being managed at any one time. That is a factor in this, as well as ICU beds, ventilators, those sorts of things. But deaths is not a sensitive indicator here.
Okay, thank you. Logan, the floor is yours.
All right, thanks, Bob. And thank you for answering all the questions, Mike, in case I'm your last one. So mine's just about communication. I am in a lot of like various Ithaca-wide groups where the community has been fairly concerned about students or parents breaking quarantine from the dangerous states. So I was wondering if senior administration has been like regularly in contact with the greater Ithaca community, and outside of that, if senior administration is preparing for and feels prepared to be in potentially constant and transparent conversation with not just like the UA, but the various constituent groups on campus.
So to the community issue, absolutely. So I did a town hall with Ryan this week. Joel was the host for it. Ithaca College participated. TC3 also participated. Lots of questions from the community about this. Martha did a meeting this week, a community meeting with community leaders of color. I have spoken to the director of Tompkins County, the supervisor of Tompkins County. Martha speaks with the chief legislator. She's speaking today with the chief legislator. I speak regularly with Tompkins County Health Department Director. Lots and lots of community discussion. I will say there is a lot of community support for what we're trying to do, as well as a lot of community anxiety. There are a lot of people in this community that recognize that if Cornell does not open, it is going to have an enormous impact on the community, far beyond Cornell. And there is a lot of concern about that, as well as the legitimate anxiety and concern about of our community. In terms of constant communication with the UA and the assemblies and others, maybe I'll turn to Joel to talk about our communication plans.
Sure, and let me just go back to the greater community. In addition to what Mike mentioned about the efforts that Martha and Mike and others have undertaken, I've got five people who run an amazing Office of Community Relations. They have regular office hours in the community, open to the general public. We have done, separate from the town halls that Mike referenced, individual neighborhood town halls. Last night I did one with the town of Dryden, the night before with Forest Home. We've done a dozen of them over the last few weeks. And each week we have multiple conversations with municipal leaders. We are not just coordinating, but we're partnering. We recognize we have a shared stake in the success of all this. With regard to UA and assembly engagement, I mentioned this, Bob, the last time I joined the UA. If you issue an invitation, we will come. Our goal is to be responsive, transparent, to answer concerns. This is not about hiding or avoiding discussion. We welcome it. I mean, if anything, you know, at this point, we're used to it because every day is filled with these discussions, but they're critical. The best way for us as a community to stay united and focused on public health is for us to continue to spend time with one another. So we will take the lead from you in terms of your interest. I extend that as well to the other assemblies. Gina is a great conduit, but please feel free to reach out at any time to me directly.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that, Joel. And yes, indeed, you've made that point very, very clear to me and others in the assembly before. And again, I'm very appreciative that Provost Kotlikoff, you were able to find the time to meet with us today on very short notice. I think that's it's a great sign, and we appreciate the opportunity to share our concerns and get some feedback from you. So it's very helpful.
Sure. Well, you know, more concerns are going to come up. This is a complicated operation, and please do reach out, and I'll come back and be glad to talk about how things are going.
Okay, appreciate that. And again, if you could, for those things you took notes on, you want to pass on to the assembly your answers, we'll broadcast them out. You know, we're just part of the community, but we hear from all parts of the constituency, so it's one more form of communication.
Sure.
We're way over time.
So let me just finally say thank you to everybody on the UA. Thank you for your efforts here. You know, this is both staff, faculty, students. This is a community effort. We're all part of this. And one of the things that's been most rewarding to me over the last 2 months is the just extraordinary effort that people are making and the commitment to Cornell. So thank you. I know people have concerns. I know we're not always going to agree, but thank you for raising issues and working on them with
me. I appreciate that. And again, we very much appreciate your time. We are over time. I've just let the meeting run because it's great to hear from you. I've been a little informal on our rules, but I think with this, we will formally adjourn the meeting. Assembly members, I will be in contact with you soon about the hearing board issues that I raised, and we'll try to get consensus. If people want a meeting, I'll call one next week, but we might be able to do it by email, and I'll let you weigh in over the weekend. So again, thank you all very much. Everyone stay safe, please. Take care.
Thank you, everyone.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.